cool to be disabled.
I'd like us all to be one big community.
Not necessarily the most politically correct.
I surely don't need to tell you.
Has it really changed your life that
you've let somebody drill into you?
We're here for our February edition of Ouch. Welcome along and thanks for being here.
This month, comedian with Asperger syndrome Don Biswas joins us to bring some topical insight.
Could you be a citizen journalist for Ouch? Meet our assistant animal correspondent and our correspondent for Cures. They'll be with us soon.
Laura Jones was paralysed from the chest down halfway through doing a dance A-level, but found a way to finish her course. We meet her, she's now a dance teacher, and she'll be talking about her current show.
It's just a couple of weeks until Paralympian Oscar Pistorius faces trial in South Africa, accused of murdering his lover, Reeva Steenkamp. We'll be talking with the BBC's Africa correspondent to find out how people are talking about it right now in South Africa.
And there's music from Kenyan blind rapper Paul Magambi.
So, stay tuned.
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
So, here we are again, Robert, once again in our lovely studio. How are you doing?
I'm feeling fairly tired, but let's see if
tired
the quality
and grumpy.
Of our...
Shocking.
I know,
shocking
isn't that unusual?
You, Rob. Shocking.
But I'm hoping the quality of our guests, no pressure whatsoever, will lift me into a state of euphoria before too long.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed, exactly. So we have Don Biswas. Hello, Don.
Hi.
And we also have Laura Jones from Stopgap Integrated Dance Company, and we'll be chatting to you a little bit more later, Laura, but hello for now.
Hi there.
Just to acknowledge your presence.
Laura's now, wearing a beautiful shade of purple, the disability colour, as we found out last
that's
week.
That's true. Would you not say it's somewhat burgundy, though?
No, I think it's purple.
I think, yeah, I've got quite a lot of purple on me, purple in the hair as well.
Except for visually impaired people like me, it just makes you look like a giant silk cup packet.
I was thinking more of a Cadbury Dairy Milk.
Oh, either way, relatively insulting, isn't it? We should be nicer to
our guests,
Kate. Yeah.
Well, anyway, let's be nicer to Don, shall we? You are a comedian with Asperger syndrome, is that right?
Yeah, I've got mild traits of Asperger syndrome as well as having dyspraxia.
Asperger's or Asperger? Solve this debate. How do you pronounce it?
I say the first one, Asperger's.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, that's what we'll go for. Now, why don't we hear a bit of you in action? We've got a clip from the King Gong show night at the Comedy Store in London.
Let me tell you two things about myself. Number one, I'm Indian, if you already hadn't guessed. And number two, I'm slightly autistic. I have problems communicating with people. I know what some of you are thinking. An Indian who can't talk to people, I should get a job in a call centre.
And I do like the fact that Don is chuckling merrily at his own gag there. So what's this? Asperger's people, they're not supposed to have a sense of humour, aren't they?
Yeah, not really. I just added a laughter track to that, so no one laughed anyway. So, well, I've got mild Asperger's, so yeah, sometimes we take things too literally, so...
But how does that manifest in daily life? Does this mean that some sort of metaphors or exaggerations in everyday conversation are interpreted incorrectly by you?
Well, for me, yeah, exactly. I can't tell if people are being sarcastic or not to a certain extent, even though I've only got on a mild basis. So I can't tell literally if people are joking or not at my workplace, so which is weird for a stand-up comedian, so...
Well, it is, but from what I've seen of your comedy, you seem to surpass it quite incredibly. But, I mean, tell us about your comedy. I mean, is it all disability-related stuff, or do you move on to other topics as well?
Well, basically, for those who don't know me, I'm of an Indian origin background. I talk about having mild Asperger's and dyspraxia. And the reason why I talk about these subjects is because comedy clubs will book me just so they can consolidate all the diversity requirements into one affordable comedian. So I just get booked because I'm the token comedian and that gets me money.
And you're quite happy to exploit that niche?
Yes,
definitely. As much as you possibly can.
As much as I can, until another dyspraxic comedian comes along. But because they have poor coordination and organisation, they probably haven't found this podcast building. So,
are there any other dyspraxic Asperger comedians that you're aware of?
Yes, I am. Unfortunately, they're locked in my basement at the moment.
What about your politics stuff, then? There is other elements rather than just talking about your conditions, isn't there?
Yeah, I'm very passionate about politics and the current state of the government. And, yeah, I thought, you know, instead of just doing one Indian joke after another or just talking about dyspraxia, I thought I'd talk about what's happening in society. Like, stuff like what Russell Brand is talking about, or Bill Hicks used to talk about, like maybe we can have a change of system.
Are you, you're after a revolution then?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. Well, something needs to change at the moment because it, nothing's great at the moment for me. I mean, there's no difference between the, both the political parties, as far as I'm concerned.
So how about what has to change, first of all? What would you say is the main things that need to be addressed?
Well, one thing I think we need to do is just help our poorest. Basically, a lot of disabled people and even poor people are being blamed for the credit crunch and they want a huge cut in welfare. So I think we need to stop demonising poor people and disabled people. Not really funny, but it's just a fact. So,
indeed. But how does this work with the fact that, as far as I'm aware, you work for a global corporate accountancy firm?
Yes, Ernest Young. So I'm only their dog's body there, so I need to deliver the packages. So.
Are you trying to do the revolution from within?
Within, yes. I'm like a secret mole or something. So.
Let's hope they don't listen to this. Otherwise, you've just given the game away. But, you know, yeah. I'm sure that's fine.
So you're 31 then, Don. You've got a diagnosis for being a bit neurodiverse, shall we say. And you got that diagnosis quite late in life. What, about 5-6 years ago? Is
yeah.
that right? Yeah. And how did you feel when you've actually realised that, oh, this is it, this is what I have, this is my condition?
It was a huge relief because I used to suffer from depression. I didn't know why. I got literally sacked from every job I ever had. So,
what kind of jobs are we talking about here?
Just normal jobs. I got sacked as an admin assistant. I had to leave a job as a management trainee because they said I was too slow. And
so when you had this diagnosis, what made you feel relieved that perhaps it's not all your fault? I mean, how did you feel?
Yeah, exactly. Because all my life, people were blaming me for being lazy. And I realised that what I actually had was having learning difficulties, as well as being lazy as well. But yeah, so yeah, it was just a huge relief. People just used to blame me for like being disorganised and stuff.
And now they can still blame you, but you've got a very good retort.
Exactly. That's the thing. Yeah. So.
Right, well, now it's time for our new, brand new topical feature, Ouch News. Welcome to Ouch News, where we recruit news correspondents from the Ouch listenership, who can bring us passion and knowledge from their corner of the disability world. This is big stuff, guys, big stuff. Let's bring on our first correspondent. We have one of our citizen journalists on the line with breaking news. Live from Dorset, it's Wendy Morell. Wendy, hello.
Hello.
And now you're new, and what are you the correspondent for?
I'm going to be the Assistance Animals correspondent.
Great. So what's the latest Assistance Animals news, Wendy? I gather it concerns a famous racing driver.
It does indeed. It started as a little sort of ripple online just before Christmas, and then the Daily Mail seemed to pick up on it, that Lewis Hamilton was photographed at Heathrow Airport with his bulldogs, one of which was wearing a service dog jacket. And for those that don't know, in the United States, the dogs that we understand as assistance dogs wear jackets that say service dog.
What's the problem here? Is it that we're not 100% sure whether or not Lewis Hamilton needs an assistance dog?
Well, certainly from my knowledge of the assistance dog world, the dog called Roscoe is a bulldog, and it wasn't wearing a jacket that is recognisable as being from any of the 7 charities that make up the umbrella organisation Assistance Dogs UK. So that's one question.
Okay.
Another question might be, maybe the dog is registered somewhere else.
We all know his brother, who has appeared on this very podcast.
Nick Hamilton. Good friend of ours.
Yeah. I mean, he has cerebral palsy. Could it be his dog? Could he have been flying him back from the States or over to the States to help Nick?
Well, from what I've seen, Nicholas may well qualify for a registered assistance dog. However, this dog, Roscoe, is widely reported as being Lewis's dog.
Could Lewis have a disability that we don't know about? Diabetes?
Well, he certainly let the cat out of the bag is probably inappropriate, but yeah, a pet out of the bag by walking around with a service dog, it does lead one to think that perhaps he does have a disability, or he's being very, very flagrantly rude.
Yep.
It's possible that he may have an impairment that we can't see or understand. How such an impairment might match with his full-time day job, it's not for me to speculate, but certainly he might. If the dog is a service dog, it would have to be based, if you like, in some other country. Now, in America, for example, the situation is slightly greyer, where they have a category of animal that isn't an assistance dog and isn't a pet. It comes somewhere in between and is called an emotional support animal. They do have special protection, and they're almost like a pets with privileges type animal, because they do have some access privileges under the law in the United States. And, you know, if you live in rented housing, for example, if you have an emotional support animal and a letter from your medical professional.
Well, I mean, I wonder if my cat could be registered as an emotional support animal. But, Don, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, this is very out there, but maybe the dog's considering joining Formula One. Maybe it'll become a driver. But they run out of humans, probably, so...
Before we get on to your other headlines, just so listeners know, now, Wendy, you're an assistance animals advocate, a disability advisor, and you do have your own assistance dog called Udo, is that right?
What does he do
for you, and why do you need him?
Well, I'm a survivor of traumatic brain injury and a wheelchair user, so I have mobility impairments and also problems with organisation and so on.
So on to your other quick stories, Wendy. Tell us briefly about the prisoners who are training assistance dogs in England. Is this something that's going to happen now, prisoners training up dogs in their spare time?
Well, it's something that's been happening in the United States for some time, but there is a lovely, reasonably new project which has been brought about by Headway Ipswich and East Suffolk. And Headway is the organisation that helps people with brain and neurological disability. Mm-hmm. And the project is called Brainy Dogs, and they got a massive £267,000 grant from the big lottery fund. And what they're doing is actually taking rescue dogs from Felixstowe Blue Cross and using prisoners from Holsley Bay Prison to train up the dogs to be companion dogs, so slightly different to the assistance dog model. As a result, the dogs tend to help people with motivation, confidence, companionship and so on.
Well, thank you so much for your breaking news on assistance animal, Wendy. Thank you so much, and it's now time for you to sign off.
I've been Wendy Morell, Assistance Animals Correspondent for Ouch News.
And we have more breaking news coming into us here in Broadcasting House, live from Vancouver, Canada now. It's Jocelyn Tomkinson. Jocelyn, what kind of disability correspondent are you?
I'm the Cures correspondent.
You are the Cures correspondent. So what is the latest Cures news, Jocelyn? Now, I've got a note here about the rather ubiquitous topic right now of 3D printing. Can you tell us a little bit about the 3D printing Cures-based progress news at the moment?
Well, 3D printing is popping up everywhere lately, and in the Cures area, it's popped up in two areas that I've heard of. One in 3D printing of retina cells for treatment of blindness, and the other in 3D printing of complex joints to for joint replacement surgery.
So hang on a minute. So, because I've seen 3D printing on the news, it's always been, you know, making quite useless things like new sofas and things like that. But this can actually be used for medical reasons, then, you're saying?
It is. In fact, it's turning out to be very useful in medical applications. And the greatest thing about this is they're using regular inkjet printers. One of the articles I stumbled across was actually from University of Cambridge, and they, some researchers there have used regular inkjet printers, although I'm sure they've taken the ink cartridges out, and they've gotten those inkjet printers to print really complex layers of cells that are used in the formation of the retina so people can see. So retinal causes of blindness could be treated by this approach if they're able to make it work in humans.
Wow. And I know this is a really hard question, but is there any kind of timeline on this? How long is it going to be before I can print out a new retina? At home.
Well, I doubt that it will ever be done at home, because
that's
what you probably have to do is culture the cells in a laboratory and then print you a new retina and then grow it up a little bit. However, you know, this article is from a mouse study, which means that it's, you know, likely 10 years off if it works in humans.
And what about hips?
hips. So there's an article going around about a Swedish girl who's had a 3D printed hip made for her. She has a complex skeletal dysplasia condition, and a regular hip replacement wouldn't work for her. And so they did a very complex three-dimensional MRI scan, and that information was fed back through a computer to a 3D printer, which used, I believe it was an acrylic, so like a plastic material, to and printed out a three-dimensional custom-made hip joint just for her.
So
I want one. I want one.
I know. Me too. I had a hip replacement, and I was like, "Where was this when I needed one?"
Well, I don't even need one, but I just want one.
No, exactly. No, for me, it's purely superficial. It's just been nice to have one lying around the house, quite frankly. But before we get on to other headlines with you, Jocelyn, listeners might want to know that you work in spinal cord injury research at a university in Vancouver, and you also host the rather wonderfully titled podcast, GIMP Hacks. Very quickly, what does GIMP Hacks mean? I can guess, but I think I'd like you to explain.
So GIMP Hacks, our podcast, is available at gimphacks.com, by the way.
Nice plug. You're listening to Ouch on the BBC. Carry on.
It's a podcast about disability life and culture, and we focus more on the sort of hacks, the way that you can make life work for you. Although we always seem to stray into sex. I don't know how that happens.
But we have that problem here. Well, we say problem. We have that situation here too. So, Jocelyn, I think we're going to have to actually wind this up a little bit early, purely because the line from Vancouver is somewhat dodgy, to put it mildly. You're breaking up slightly. We will have you on again, though, we promise. So just for now, could you do your official BBC Ouch correspondent sign-off, and we'll talk to you very soon.
I've been Jocelyn Tomkinson, Curious Correspondent, reporting for Ouch News.
And if you want to be a correspondent, email us ouch@bbc.co.uk or tweet @BBCOuch and tell us what you know lots about in your corner of the specialist disability world.
Any preferences, Kate?
I'd like some monkey news.
Would you? Yeah. I'd like a metal hand correspondent.
Specific?
Yeah, and dogs on wheels. Don, any specialisations?
No, I like the one about assistant pets. That really interested me. If we can have more on that.
More assistant pets. Okay. Laura?
Well, obviously from my area, it's the sort of dance and arts worlds that I'm interested in. So more on that would be great.
Fine. Let us make it so.
Yes, let's make it happen. So now let's turn to Laura. Now, you, as you just said there, you are a teacher and performer with the Stopgap Dance Company, and you've just started touring with Artificial Things, your latest dance production. Now, let me read what it says about Artificial Things on your website.
Mm-hmm.
Slowly suffocating in each other's company, a group of individuals seek escape in a bash of riotous rock and roll. However, their wild disorder descends into playground politics and reveals some uncomfortable truths. In this cinematic and evocative production, Stopgap Dance Company creates a compact world of riddles that questions our notions about unity and coexistence. So, it sounds very dramatic. So, what's it actually about?
quite.
Dance doesn't really translate into words terribly well, does it?
No, but I'll give it a go. We've created a world in this dance piece, and it's got three different sections that we take the audience through. We're kind of trying to draw the audience into this very specific, beautiful world. And we start with kind of introducing them to the dancers and the characters within it. And then it goes on this kind of slightly crazy journey where it all gets a bit mad and chaotic, and that kind of rock and roll bit of fun goes a little bit too far. And then sort of in the third section, it's about a resolution to the piece and it kind of coming together and understanding. And there's themes of being on the outside, understanding each other, working together, and trying to come together to work together.
And is it all people with disabilities in the dance group?
No, there's a mixture in the dance company. At the moment we've got five performers within the professional performance company, three of whom have disability. Myself, I have a spinal injury and use a wheelchair. We have Chris Pavia, who has Down syndrome. Dave Toole, who people might have recognised from the Paralympic opening ceremony. He was the dancer without any legs who did the beautiful solo. And we also have David Wildridge and Amy Butler, who are non-disabled dancers within the company.
Great. Well, I mean, let's go back to the beginning of your dance career then. When did you start dancing?
Well, I've been interested in dance really ever since I can remember. It was my first memory was being in a dance class. It's something that I've always enjoyed. I've always had a passion for. So I did that as a young girl. I went along to dance classes.
Ballet, tap, modern jazz.
Everything. You know, that whole, yeah, absolutely. And loved it all. Did all the shows and took my dance exams and everything. And
that's a lot of different costumes.
Absolutely, yes. And a lot of different kind of getting your hair scraped back for exams and things like that.
Wasn't hard to know what to buy you for Christmas.
No,
was
absolutely.
It?
So, yeah, I really enjoyed it. And then it got to the point where I was sort of 15, 16 thinking, okay, what am I actually going to do with my life now? I need to start thinking about that. And dance seemed the obvious choice. It was, you know, what I've always enjoyed, what I've always had a passion for. So I thought, you know, I've got to give this a go and see if I can make it as a dancer.
So you started A-levels, is that right?
That's right, yes. So I chose to go to college to study A-level dance. And then it was a week into studying my A-levels, I then suffered from a spinal bleed, which left me paralysed and had to spend a year in hospital for recovery and rehabilitation.
I can't imagine what that must have been like, having grown up, you know, with this idea that you were going to be a dancer and that was it. You know, you were focused on that. And then all of a sudden, did it just happen one day? How did you have an injury that caused the bleed, or what actually happened?
No, there was nothing external that that triggered the bleed. I had recently been on a long-haul flight, and whilst the doctors cannot say for certain that affected it, I think, you know, personally, I feel that there's a high probability that was a factor in it. It was out of the blue, no warning. I started getting a pain in my back, and within a few hours was in hospital, not being able to feel my legs.
That must have been incredibly scary.
Yes. You know, not having any idea what was going on or why it was. And the medical staff also not really being able to put their finger on what was happening either. And yeah, she said, having been a very active young person, to suddenly wind up and be in hospital, having to deal with the fact that I wouldn't be able to walk again.
How did you manage to get back on track and think, actually, do you know what, I am going to keep dancing, this isn't going to stop me?
Well, it was something that, to start with, I had absolutely no idea that it was even a possibility. I was there thinking, oh, crikey, so if I can't walk, surely that means I can't dance. What the heck am I going to do now? And really couldn't think of anything else that I wanted to do. So thankfully, my tutors at college were very supportive, and they were really encouraging for me to come back and say, yes, you can still do the dance A-level. Yeah, we can make this work. We can figure out a way through together. And, you know, come and give it a try.
And had anyone done a dance A-level before who was a wheelchair user?
As far as I know, I'm the first person to complete 100% of the A-level dance syllabus. So originally I was thinking, well, maybe I'd just be doing the theory. And then we kind of, as the syllabus progressed, as the course progressed, we looked at it and said, well, yes, of course I can do the choreography, because yeah, that's choreographing on other people. But then it was the more complex things of, you had to learn a set study, and you also had to learn notation and be able to perform that notation. And that took a lot more figuring it out, but we did work it out in the end. And so I did complete 100% of the syllabus, and believe I'm the first person in a wheelchair to do that.
Wow, so you're blazing a trail for other young dancers then.
Indeed, yes. And that's something that actually is quite exciting, that I have been able to do that, and hopefully that they're, you know, that's then allowing other people to come through the system.
And what kind of dance is it that you do now then?
Mm-hmm. So now I work for Stopgap Dance Company. I joined them in 2001, having finished my A-levels. And it's a contemporary dance company that's integrated, that has dancers with both with and without disabilities.
And what does a kind of normal show look like for you guys then? What kind of thing will we see on the stage?
Well, we're really interested in working with each dancer as an individual and drawing out each individual's strengths and abilities and then putting them together and seeing how they mix within the group and how we can work together as a group. We take inspiration, obviously, from the dancers, but from lots of different things. And we've had external choreographers come in and work with us, and they have their own idea of what they want to create, what piece they're going to make on the company. And then recently with this new work, it's been more internal choreography. So we've been working together as a company to create this piece.
Can I ask you a question? You know, girl to girl, you are very skinny. And you are, you know, I don't know how you do it, because I am getting married in the summer and I need to lose some weight. How do you keep yourself thin and in a wheelchair? Because I find it really difficult. If I can't move very much, I like a bit too much chocolate.
But how do we all do, don't we?
Exactly. How do you keep yourself fit and active and healthy?
Well, it's interesting because when I was newly disabled and was getting my first wheelchair, and they measured me up and they said, right, you're this width, and actually we're going to give you a wheelchair that's a bit wider than that. And I was like, well, but why can't I have the one that is the width? The fits, absolutely. And they said, oh, well, because you're put on weight. You're put on weight. Everyone does. You know, once you're in a wheelchair and you can't be that active, you're put on weight. I was like, no, I really don't think I will. And I didn't. Because certainly with the dancing, we work, I'm contracted 4 days a week. And, you know, every day we're very active. We do a company class in the morning, a kind of technical workout, and then, you know, most of the day we're either rehearsing or creating or teaching. And yeah, you've got to eat all that chocolate because, you know, you've got to have all that energy to then be able to work. So yeah.
Dom, do you keep fit? Is this something important to you?
It is. I'd just like to say one thing on the side, that my proud, traditional, middle-class Indian parents always wanted me to become a dancer, but I wanted to do medicine instead. I've started to go to the gym because I'm dyspraxic. It took me ages. I was always get picked last for sports teams and stuff like that. So I only just do a little bit of running. That's it. But a question I would like to ask, one day hopefully we could see disability dancers and Strictly Come Dancing or something like that, hopefully.
Well, I believe, aren't we having one for Sport Relief? Isn't there going to be somebody, Hannah Cockcroft, is that right? Is going to be
look
on,
at me, I have no idea.
Is she? Strictly Come Dancing for Sport Relief? Yes, she is. We spoke to her last month or the month before.
Did we?
Yeah.
Did you know that Hannah Cockcroft's going to be on Strictly Come Dancing? I thought you would have known that, Kate.
Thicko. And Lee Pearson's going to be a judge.
You see, I told you that, didn't I? Only moments ago.
You are so up on your reality TV.
On the ball.
Finger on the
pulse. I'm a little bit, I'm just going to quickly butt in and ask you, Laura, I'm a little bit obsessed with aerial dancing. Mm-hmm. I quite liked it at the Paralympics, of which you were one, I believe, were you? Yeah.
I didn't actually get to do the aerial work. No, I did audition for it.
Oh, did you?
No. I mean, yes, I did audition, but unfortunately I wasn't able to. It just wasn't going to quite work out for me to be one of the aerialists.
Tell us what it is, though, aerial dancing.
Aerial dancing.
I wasn't seeing it, because it's amazing.
It is amazing, yes. And, well, hopefully people have seen in the Paralympic opening ceremony. But there's various different types of aerial dancing, different equipment that they use, from harnesses to ropes to silks to rings, various different ways of kind of being suspended midair and basically defying gravity and looking quite spectacular as they do it.
Rob, can we get you up there? Can we hoist you up to do some aerial dancing?
I doubt you'd be
Please.
Able to hoist me up, Kate.
Okay, not me personally, but I feel like some kind of, you know, there's going to be a specialist dance area. This is something you could do.
Well, it's a while since I've been humiliated on the Ouch show.
Yeah,
so, yeah,
exactly.
It's been a few years since I was publicly humiliated every single month as the roving reporter.
I think this is time.
I've got no great desire to go back.
Laura, could you teach Rob how to do this?
I'm sure I could, yeah. I think there's a potential in there, yeah.
I'm not sure it's going to make fantastic radio, but you will at least get to hear the sounds of me yelling and screaming in pure, unadulterated
and that
terror.
Is fantastic radio to me.
Now, what we should say about these aerial dancers is that they're up very, very high, and they have most of the time, some of the time, no safety net?
Yeah, indeed. Some of the time they are attached to harnesses, and that's kind of the different equipment that they use. Sometimes they are actually attached and then they're not going to go anywhere. But some of the time when they're using ropes or silks, then they're not actually, they can't be attached to a harness because that would then get tangled up. And then they don't necessarily have a safety net below them. Certainly, I was quite
Blimey.
In awe of in the opening ceremony how high yeah. they had to have the rope workers up, just because of the sheer size of the stadium, to actually make it look spectacular. They were incredibly high up, and from being in the stadium and kind of watching it from the field of play and kind of
this
looking
is at the Paralympics.
And, yes, absolutely. Looking up at them,
what's going through their minds? They're just thinking, "Oh, well, I'm already pretty physically disabled. What's a fall going to do now?" Quite frankly,
I think that might be on the minds of the organisers. They yeah. just think we don't need to put a safety net in here. It's fine.
The insurance costs, frankly, the mind boggles. But anyway,
yeah, I don't know what hoops they had to jump through, health and safety. Safety-wise, to get that through.
All of them, I imagine. Now, before we go, I just wanted to also point out that you are in a clique of possibly one, where you are a dancer who is also a Real Ale fan.
Indeed. Oh, I do love Real Ale. Yes, yes. That's something that I've, I think, been brought up and enjoyed. I think part of it is that I've obviously got the dance side. I work as a contemporary dancer, but I was also brought up in the folk dance side, and Real Ale is definitely a very important part of folk dancing.
Yeah.
Yes.
We had a beer on a couple of months ago, which was made by, a disabled brewery in Sweden? It was called Wheelchair Ale. Cerebral Palsy Beer, that's what it was. Have you come across this yet?
Crip Ale or something?
It's called Crip Ale.
CPA. CPA.
Do you have a favourite? Well, you do now, because I've just told you about Cerebral Palsy Ale.
Obviously,
but until 5 seconds ago, what was your favourite ale?
I do like a bit of Sarah Hughes Ruby Mild. That's definitely one of my favourites.
Where does that come from? What's it taste like?
It tastes great. It's lovely and smooth and full flavoured and malty and yes. Really
no,
do
I'm
enjoy
not going to try that. No.
Well,
no
see, ale for with, me. The thing is with Real Ale is there's such a variety of different tastes that you can't say you don't like it. You just haven't found the right one for you.
I mean, is there any that tastes like strawberry shortcake?
Yeah.
That's definitely strawberry ale.
Really?
There's definitely, and certainly another one of my favourites is a chocolate orange ale.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Now I'm interested.
You could get on board with that.
Now I'm interested,
yes.
Yep.
At some point I will get Kate to stop swigging from that warm bottle of Blue Nun, but it could be a while. But I'd like to say, thank you very much, Laura. It's been lovely talking to you.
Thank you.
Ouch.
Talking disability.
I put myself on a dating site once and I didn't mention that I had a disability, and I got loads and loads of emails asking for dates and stuff. Obviously, I had to tell them I had a disability, and then there was just like no more emails. I put myself on as having a disability and I just didn't get any emails whatsoever, so I think it is very image-orientated.
bbc.co.uk/ouch
The trial of disabled amputee Oscar Pistorius isn't far away now. It's on March the 3rd. And Pistorius is facing a charge of premeditated murder of his girlfriend Reva Steinkamp, plus illegal gun possession and two other unrelated firearms charges. On the line, we've got Andrew Harding, the BBC's Africa correspondent. Hello, Andrew.
Yes, hi.
Now, we want to talk about the mood before the trial in a moment, but can we just go over the events of Valentine's Day last year briefly, first of all?
Yes, well, basically what Oscar Pistorius said happened is that his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, stayed over, but in the middle of the night, he went out to the balcony to open or close the window and bring a fan in. Then he heard a noise from the bathroom, picked up a gun, ran over to the bathroom, thought it was a burglar inside the toilet in the bathroom behind a closed door, shot four times into the door, and then realized that he'd made a mistake and that it was actually his girlfriend who'd got out of bed while he was out closing the window. He battered the door down with a cricket bat and took her down, but she was dead pretty much there and then. Now, what the prosecution is saying is that's nonsense, that the two had been rowing, that some neighbours heard rowing, that this was a jealous lover with a history of firearms offences and an explosive temper, and that he the forensics will show that he had time not merely to get out of bed on his stumps, but to put his blades on his legs so that he could go over and walk into the bathroom, shoot his girlfriend deliberately. That's what the prosecution are claiming.
Now, Andrew, where does Oscar belong in the hearts of South Africans, and how do they view him now?
A very difficult question. I mean, before this happened, he was a superstar. He really was an extraordinary example of, in a way, this country. You know, this is a nation that's pretty new, pretty young, that was forged with violence and extraordinary leadership, and overcame all these challenges to become the Rainbow Nation that, you know, it is today. And some people saw Oscar Pistorius as somehow mirroring that. He was a young man who overcame extraordinary odds to be this global success story of resilience and achievement. And now, of course, all that seems to have been destroyed, regardless of whether you think he deliberately killed his girlfriend or not.
Mm. Now, what kind of stories are emerging locally in South Africa pre-trial? I should say that you're in Johannesburg at the moment. What are you hearing in the weeks leading up to the commencement?
Well, a lot of focus has been on the civil claim. Basically, Reeva Steenkamp's parents are saying, we are poor, we were relying on our daughter's income, and you have killed her, and we would like some money. And we understand negotiations are still ongoing between the Pistoriuses and the Steenkamps about that deal. There's no news about it yet. We're also waiting to hear whether or not television cameras or audio recordings will be allowed in the court itself in Pretoria. The suspicion is that they won't be allowed, but that's going to be something that's going to be debated in front of the judge, probably in the next week or so.
And it seems important at this point to point out that this story isn't all about the downfall of Oscar Pistorius. It's also very much about the horrific, violent death of a young woman as well. I mean, do you think that that side of the story is being adequately reported in South Africa and worldwide?
It is. And, of course, it depends what angle you take on the case. What was it deliberate, in which case this falls into a pattern in a country where there is appalling violence against women, where sexual violence particularly often is unreported, but is at a brutally high level. And yet other people will say, look, this was just a terrible accident. You can't generalize off the back of this about treatment of women, because, of course, they'll say Pistorius wasn't trying to kill a woman. He was trying to kill a burglar. The other issue, of course, is about crime and about the number of firearms that are held, and sort of about a culture where it's okay to have guns in your house, and it's okay, or considered okay, to shoot a burglar before you've even seen him.
Stay with us there for a moment, if you would, Andrew. A long-running investigative programme in South Africa, Carte Blanche, are to broadcast a 24-hour TV channel starting the day before the trial begins. George Mazarakis is its executive producer, and he spoke to us about what this channel aims to do.
This is the first in South African broadcasting in this kind of context. Well, the reason we're doing it is because, obviously, there's enormous public interest in Oscar. He's a South African icon in many, many ways. And it's a profound tragedy that this has happened, of course. So we're looking at the life of Oscar and how his life is going to be affected by the fact that Reeva lost hers. It's just a very sad story all the way around. But at the same time, it's an important story about the justice system and how that works, and just generally to try and make sense of what happened. You know, I think that people can't help feeling sorry for him because they also loved him very much. But at the same time, a very beautiful young woman also lost her life. So I think that people change their minds fairly often about it. They can't make up their minds as to how to feel about it.
Well, I'm struggling to figure out how a 24-hour news channel is going to work covering this trial if it looks probable that there won't be any media access inside the courtroom, Andrew.
Yes, and that's key, obviously. If it is allowed inside, then they'll do very well. If not, then I suspect there's going to be an awful lot of repeating the same documentaries and so on. And that really, it probably won't be a great deal more coverage than many other channels will also be doing, because, you know, as you pointed out there is enormous public interest in this story. Not so much, I suspect, for what it says about South Africa, but because it is simply an extraordinary drama. And I think a lot of people are still not sure what really happened in that bathroom, but are very keen to find out.
Don and Laura, if he is found to be innocent of premeditated murder, can his reputation withstand this whole saga anyway? Or, you know, do you think we will bring him back into our hearts as an icon for disability?
It's a hard one, really. First thing I'd like to say about the 24-hour news channel, just with recent events in South Africa, I just hope they employ the right sign language guy. So
yes. That would be helpful, wouldn't it?
That would be helpful, hopefully. I think it's hard. I think his reputation, like Lance Armstrong, I think it is tarnished already quite badly. So And to me, we have to wait and see what the trial happens, but it doesn't look good for Oscar at the moment.
So, Andrew, what can you tell us about trials in South Africa and how it might differ from a murder trial in the UK?
Well, for a start, it won't be a jury trial. It'll be one judge, probably with two assessors who will help her to cross-examine witnesses and to sift through the evidence and reach a judgment. But it means that the media are under fewer restrictions in general. There's a precedent here for the media to be pretty free in what they say and in the analysis they give, and because there is the assumption that a judge would not be swayed, would not be manipulated by what he or she read in the media.
And I think a lot of people in the UK particularly would be quite surprised at the brevity of the trial. It's only going to last a fortnight. Is that quite normal for South Africa?
No, it won't last a fortnight. It's going to last a lot longer. They put aside 3 weeks, but South African trials drag on for months, if not years. In fact, you know, it's taken a year to get to trial, but that is incredibly quick by South African standards. And although I know the historians want this to go fast, it's going to be very expensive apart from anything else, the likelihood is that it's going to be many more weeks than 2 or 3.
Well, it's a fascinating story, Andrew. I really appreciate your time from Johannesburg. That's the BBC's Africa correspondent, Andrew Harding. Thank you very much.
And a big thank you to all our guests on today's show, Don Biswas, Laura Jones and our lovely correspondents.
And here ends February's show. We'll be back next month with more talk and people watching. If you like listening to us, then why not tell a friend or do some shameless promotion for us? The last time we did this, we had people putting up posters in hospital clinics and all sorts. Send us the evidence and we will mention you. Please try and stay on the legal-ish side, though.
Legal-ish. Remember, just that ish at the end there. Anyway, thanks as usual to the team, Emma Tracy, studio manager Rob Winter and producer Damon Rose. We are playing you out with a song as usual, and this one is from Kenya, and we think it's in Swahili.
And in it, blind rapper Paul Magambi incorporates positive, motivational lyrics such as, "If I made it, even you will make it." And work hard, put efforts, advocate for yourself, a person with disability. And they call it disability in English. True, the word is very interesting, including lions and elephants.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's World Disability Music brought to you by Ouch at the BBC. It may not translate directly, but it's all heart and right on politics. Are you hearing me, brothers and sisters?
I hear you, sister.
Until next month, this is Never Never Give Up.
Sijokaleta majigambo, ulemavu ni moja wangu ya zangu urembo. Ukitaka muulize ule wa kampo. Wakule ngabo, wanaita disability yani kwa lugha ya kimombo. Kweli dunia ina mambo, wanajua hesabu ya wanyama pori, kina simba na ndovu lakini hawana kopi ya walemavu. Ewe kazana, ah, pambana, jitetee ewe mlemavu, uwe kama kina Teso Boy, Mugambi na kina Esther Ingolo. Ni wengi waliozoea kunidisi, hivi sasa wanatamani kunikiss. Waliokuwa kinidisi, hivi sasa wanatamani kunimiss. Enye chekeni tu uko shambani wakati mina wacheka sokoni. Adabu ya shingo kutolala kitandani. Usidharau madafu maembe ni ya msimu. Wanaharakati kawa ngari madhai. That's why sifungi tai. Ukinitae mbaba haukosei. Yeah! Timotua anajivunia najurumia wakati Kenya inazidi umia. Serikali imejazana ndugu wanaojuana. That's why hakuna alama ya mlemavu. Kina Kivunja commission washatusahau. Ndugu zangu wanaombaomba mitaani. Dada zangu nao wanauza. Wamechoka kutelemsha zao sindiria. Na wanatumiwa kuuza madawa ya kulevya. Copy affirmative action. Tulichobakia ni discrimination na marginalization. Sina baba wala mama mbunge. Wanaendelea tu kuteswa tu wanyonge. Wanasawia kwa society na kuwajali na vina na treat minority. Mkichukua ma white cane morelas na white crutches amta tuweza bora tu mnifunge. Serikali mahuluti, wadosi washafungwa midomo na noti. Wanaharakati na washavalishokoti. Ni bora mnimalizie kwa baruti ama gruneti.